Welcome to the what will be the first in a three-part series titled B'chol Dor V'Dor, in each and every generation. But we're really going to be looking at the history of the Haggadah of Seder, really reconstructing the Haggadah as it's kind of moved through the generations, and also look at how Seder night developed into what it is today. I'll admit from the outset that this is, for me at least, I think one of the coolest things I've ever kind of gone through from a learning perspective, though I will warn you in advance, some of the things we have to do aren't necessarily boring, but there's a certain repetitive, close reading of things that we, the latter half of today, if those of you already kind of flicking through the source sheet, you'll start to see basically the second half of the source sheet is entirely basically Mishnayot, and which we will be close reading in order to tease out all of the things that have happened, and that's awesome, but it is kind of, you know, there is, at a certain point, in order to sometimes discover really awesome things, you have to do sometimes some very repetitive kind of skills have to be applied in order to tease out the awesome stuff, but I am very excited for this. I think I've mentioned in the past how Megillat Esther is my favorite Sefer in Tanakh, so I love Purim for that reason, but Pesach is my favorite holiday. In part, I love Pesach because it's just so immersive, it's you know, when we think of the other Chagim, we don't necessarily prepare ourselves, maybe as much as we should, even with the Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. There's always a point at which it's like, oh, that's next week. You know, but with Pesach, we can't help it. We have to. And so I love the fact that we program ourselves to start thinking about Pesach in advance, start doing what we are doing already. And also on Pesach itself, it always feels like Pesach. On Rosh Hashanah, you go home after shul, and it feels like a regular Shabbat or Yom Tov afternoon without, you know, a clear conscious effort to make it otherwise. But with Pesach, you can't ever avoid Pesach because, you know, you want to eat. Oh, it's Pesach. You know, so you know, and that's something I love about Pesach is it feels like Pesach the whole time. And I really like that sense, that feeling. But particularly the Seder. The Seder really is a microcosm of everything we do in Judaism. Obviously, we eat, we have a Yom Tov meal, we have Kiddush, we have Hamotzi, and we have unique Pesach-specific rituals like Maror, we do Hallel, and we have that sense of almost that davening sense of taking place also at the Seder. You know, we sing random songs, obviously there's an element of Torah learning, there's the family-orientated aspect to the Seder. It's really practically everything we do as Jews, if you would like put it in a box. That, you know, that same idea from that box is somehow found on Seder night. And that's really amazing. Even, and this is kind of a more, you know, less serious example, but there are some people, some Haggadot that print the verses that we only ever recited to Brit Milah, you know, to really capture this idea that it's a microcosm of everything. We're even, you know, somehow or another recalling a Brit Milah as we're on Seder night. Not actually, but nonetheless, you know, we do everything on the Seder night, and that makes it very unique, but that also raises the question of, well, how did we get to here? How did we get to this kind of really magnificent, incredible, you know, smorgasbord of, you know, everything we do as Jews? How did we get to what we are going to do in a few weeks from now at Seder night? And so what we're going to look at over the next couple of weeks, tonight and next week also, is the history of the Haggadah. How it developed. We're going to start today with kind of the Torah itself and start to trace kind of how Seder night develops throughout history until the times of the Tanaim, until the times of the Mishnah, and to really understand and see that the Seder and the Haggadah take shape. And then next week we'll see how the Haggadah continued to take shape, how Seder night continued to take shape until it became the form that is reminiscent and basically identical to what we do today. And then in the final week we'll look at how the Haggadah has also contributed significant aspects of Jewish philosophy. How there are certain theological ideas that the Haggadah itself is emphatic about, and they have really stayed with us as Jews, and at the same time, how we as Jews, especially in the 20th and 21st century, how we've reinterpreted the Haggadah. And so we're going to look at least one case study in each of those examples and see how, it's fascinating in the third week how we have literally changed the meaning of some of the key aspects of the Haggadah. So that's kind of just an overview of what we're going to do. And what will hopefully come through all of this, and especially tonight, is how ancient the Haggadah is. And there is something really cool about realizing that Jews have been doing this for longer than they've been doing anything else. If you compare it to kind of the history of the Siddur, not even close. We find some tefillot, you read, say, Masechet Brachot, the Gemara of Masechet Brachot, and you come across, some significant tefillot. But the Mishnayot are already describing things that are already being done for Jews, generations earlier, and we are doing those same things, and there's something really, I don't want to repeat the word that I was using during the Megillat Esther stuff, but there's something majestic about that. There's something really cool and mind-blowing about reading the sources we're going to see tonight, about realizing they were doing this then, and we are still doing this now, and it's more or less stayed the same, because again, the Siddur, yeah, there's a lot of things we do that are the same, but there's a lot of things that, we do that are just very different, that had never been done in the past. And so what we're, part of the beauty of what we're doing tonight is really seeing, the Haggadah and the Seder night crystallize already from the earliest moments of Jewish history. And with that, if everyone can take a look at the first source on the sheet, as you'd expect, every discussion of Pesach, the Seder night, has to begin with the very first Pesach observed in Mitzrayim as the Jewish people are leaving Egypt. And this is just an excerpt from the Parakim, the chapters in Sefer Shemot in the book of Exodus that deal with leaving Egypt. And Moshe and God says the following. Source number one. Dabru el kol adat Yisrael lemor. And as I'm reading this and translating it, pick up on, what things do we already see that are key components of the Seder night to this day. One of them isn't anymore, but nonetheless, look for the key components of Seder night. Dabru el kol adat Yisrael lemor. Speak to the whole community and say, Be'esor lachodesh hazeh, on the 10th of this month, vayikhu lahem ish seh levet avot seh labayit, take a lamb for each household, ve'im yim'at habayit miyot miseh, if the household is too small for one lamb, ve'lakachu shcheino hakarov el beito b'michsat nefashot, share it with other people kind of around you, ish lefi achlo tachosu al seh. You're split it up among kind of the households. And then we get a bit about what the lamb should look like. Setamim zachar ben shnah yeh lachem. It should be without blemish. It should be a male that's young. Min hakvasim umin ha'izim tikachu. What kinds you can take from. It can be from the sheep or the goat. V'haya lachem lemishmeret. And it shall be for you. You shall keep watch on it. Sorry. Ad arba asar yom lachodesh hazer. Until the 14th. V'shachatu oto kol kehaladat Yisrael ben ha'arbaim. Everyone should, slaughter it then. V'lakchu min hadam, take the blood, v'natnu al shtei hamzuzot v'al hamashkof, put them on the doorposts, al habatim ashe yochlu oto bahem, v'ochlu et habasar balayla hazesh, sli'esh u'matzot al morarim yocheluhu. Eat it with matzah and marrow. There are four major aspects of Seder night that already come out from just these verses themselves. One of which, again, we don't do anymore, for reasons that will become clear if they're not already known. What four major things from this paragraph alone, the key components of Seder night, are already found in these early psukim of the Torah? Two of them are, I feel like some people are like, it's so obvious it can't be, but yes, it's about as obvious as it gets. Yeah, matzah and marrow, together with what's really the whole focus of these psukim, these verses. The Pesach, the Korban Pesach. So we don't do this anymore, but Pesach, matzah, marrow are the three fundamental ingredients of Seder night, and the Torah already has, these three. There's a fourth thing, a fourth quality already within this paragraph. In some sense, you have to read kind of between the lines, but what's a key focal aspect also of Seder night already in the Torah? Exactly. Get together with the family, and if you don't have a family to get together with, or your family is too small, get together with other people. It's a communal event. Already, these four major aspects of Seder night are in the Torah themselves. The Pesach, the Matzah, and the Maror, and also the communal emphasis. And finally, just a few pesukim later, in the same chapter, and again, Moshe repeats the same thing just one parak later also, V'haya, still source number one, the next paragraph. V'haya ki yomru aleichem b'neichem, ma ha'avodah hazod lachem. And when your children ask, why are we doing this? V'yamartem zevach pesachu ladunai, asher pasach al batei b'nei Yisrael b'mitzrayim. It's because of God, he passed over the homes of the b'nei Yisrael, b'nagfot mitzrayim et bateinu hitzil. He smote the Egyptians, he saved us. And then the people bow low. That picks up again with the narrative. What's the fourth element already found in the Torah? More broadly? Yeah, education. We already have the idea that you pass on to the next generation the story of Pesach. Already the very first Pesach night, before there was a Seder. Before there was what we do today, the Jewish people were already commanded to do Pesach, Matzah, Maror in a group setting and with some focus on education. With some focus on passing on, making sure everyone's aware of why we are celebrating this. We don't have this with any other mitzvot. There's no obligation on Sukkot. Why are we starting the sukkah? Well, let me tell you, we don't. It's cold. Okay, let's go inside. But fundamentally, the only time we have an obligation to actually make sure everyone's aware of what we're doing, Seder night. And it comes already from the Torah. So already we see some of the key building blocks. And this is what I think it's expected because yes, this is kind of how Judaism works, but it is kind of cool that these key building blocks are already being found already in these verses. And if you take a look at source number two, source number two introduces another quality which is not something relevant to us nowadays, but is going to be key shortly. In Sefer Devarim it says, "Lo tuchal lizboch et haPesach be'echad she'arecha." You can't slaughter it kind of in your own place. Asher Adonai Elohecha notein lach, that God has given you. It's talking about you're not going to be the land of Israel. Ki im halamakom asher yivchar Adonai Elohecha l'shaken shemo sham. L'shaken shemo sham tizbach et haPesach ba'erev. You can only go to the place God himself will choose. Kvo Hashemesh moitzi itchem mitzrayim. Evening at sundown. The Pesach had to be slaughtered in a very specific place. Which, trying to be more interactive here, but people have to interact. Yeah, Yerushalayim, the Beit HaMikdash, it has to take, you can't just do it where, you can't just do it in your own home. You have to go to Yerushalayim, and you have to do it there. So Sefer Devarim actually already introduces us to a quality that's going to be key. Very shortly, is the fact that it's technically restricted to Yerushalayim, it's technically restricted to, you know, the environs around the Beit HaMikdash in order to celebrate Pesach. So we have a restrictive element here. As much as we've seen so many of the elements of Seder night already in the Torah, it also restricts them. They can only be done in Yerushalayim, which is obviously about as far a departure from what we do nowadays as could possibly be. So we'll have to understand, even though it's kind of obvious what changes, we'll have to understand exactly, you know, what changes and why the Seder looks like it does now. The cool thing about Pesach is that there are other examples of it being observed in the rest of Nach. Often it's more observed in the breach than anything else, as in it's remarkable that they observe it, because in previous other times, they never observed it. So it's kind of, you know, nonetheless. For instance, in Sefer Yehoshua says, as they are, you know, I mean, Vayachadu b'nei Yisrael b'Gilgal, they're in Gilgal. They've just, all the men have circumcised themselves. Vayasu et haPesach, b'arba'asa yom l'chodesh ba'erev ba'arvot Yericho. On the steeps of Yericho, of Jericho, they celebrate Pesach. Vayachlu me'avo ha'aretz mimracharat haPesach matzot v'kaloi be'etzem hayom hazed. They eat matzah. So once again, we see the celebration of Pesach taking place when the Jews first enter the land of Israel. And in other Sifrei Tanakh, so for instance, the Sefer Melachim and Divrei Hayamim, the Book of Kings and the Book of Chronicles, attest to Yoshiyahu Josiah's religious reforms. One of the major aspects of his religious reforms is the celebration of Pesach, which had not been celebrated until that point. That's why it's kind of observed in the breach. But you have various references. Pesach's mentioned in Sefer Ezra. Right at the end of Tanakh, we have a lot of, you know, random references to Pesach being observed, often to highlight how often it was not observed in periods of time in Jewish history, But nonetheless, it's significant to see so many of the major building blocks. Pesach Matzah Maror, group setting, and, you know, education element being seen already, being an evening meal. All these things that are going to become key components of the Seder are already found, you know, in some form or another in Tanakh.
And in non-Jewish.
We're going to get to that. Because the cool thing is what happens after Tanakh. So in the Bayit Sheni period, in the Second Temple period, we have far more evidence now of things starting to take shape a bit more. Generally, when it comes to evidence about things Jews did in the Second Temple, while some Mishnayot, and I'm going to talk about this a bit more shortly, while some Mishnayot reference things that took place during the Second Temple era, most things in the Mishnah and on are post Second Temple, but we have two major resources for seeing what Jews did in the Second Temple. The first is the apocryphal works. So the apocryphal works didn't get canonized into Tanakh itself. So one example of this is the Book of Jubilees. The Book of Jubilees is seen canonical by at least some aspects of the church. I think it's like the Eastern Orthodox Church has the Book of Jubilees in its canon. It was found in Qumran. It was found among the Dead Sea Scrolls, at least in fragments. So they kept it also. They thought it was part of their canon. The Hebrew that exists is fragmentary. And so kind of, if you go online nowadays, you know, and find kind of a Hebrew English Book of Jubilees, it's just a translation. Both are translations. So, you know, it's not, the Hebrew is not original. But take a look at the Book of Jubilees. So the Book of Jubilees here is describing the first kind of Pesach. And obviously, in its description, it is reflecting the Pesach that would take place in the time of the Book of Jubilees in the Second Temple period. And it says in source number 4, and all Israel was eating the flesh of the Pesach and drinking the wine and was lording and blessing and giving thanks to the Lord God of their fathers and was ready to go forth under the yoke of Egypt and from the evil bondage. Things have been added now. Things that we have not seen occurring in Tanakh as part of the celebration of Pesach have suddenly emerged as already in the Bayit Sheni period being crucial to the celebration of Pesach. Michael, you are nodding. You want to?
The Torah portion ends basically the end of the word Pesach, right?
Yeah, but what?
The rest is not mentioned.
Correct. So and this is describing, well, the Book of Jubilees is really doing is describing Pesach as it took place in Bayit Sheni and reflecting that back into kind of these, you know, much as, you know, if you walk into some shuls, you know, they will read kind of modern Judaism back into the sources of the Torah. You know, the famous question of did the patriarchs keep, you know, the mitzvah, that kind of reflects, well, they have to have done it because we do it nowadays. So the Book of Jubilees is basically saying, they celebrated Pesach. They must have celebrated Pesach the way we celebrate Pesach. But it describes two more crucial aspects of Seder night that we have not seen in any sources in Tanakh itself. But suddenly these things are now being done. Again, they kind of slip us by because they are so obvious components of Seder night, but we've not seen them in the Torah or in Tanakh thus far. Yep, wine. Drinking wine. No specification on how much wine is being drunk, but the Torah had no mention of wine being drunk. Suddenly, we know in Bayit Sheni, Jews are drinking wine at Seder also. And the other thing, so, but what kind of, yeah, the problem with this English translation is it kind of masks the explicit kind of Hebrew word that we would use, lording and blessing and giving thanks.
Hallel.
Yeah, hallel. Hallel was also being done already in Bayit Sheni. And there are other sources of Chazal which seem to be referencing things that took place in the Beit HaMikdash, which seem to corroborate the fact that hallel was a major component of the Seder of Pesach night in Bayit Sheni. Obviously, it's a major component of the Seder today. Hallel is still a major thing. And we also have the idea of drinking wine. And I think what you are alluding to, Leora, is maybe the most famous Seder, even though scholars actually debate whether it's actually Seder night because some sources dispute that, the most famous Seder night in history, and it's not in a Jewish source. Yeah, it's the Last Supper. So I've mentioned this before in a variety of contexts. The Christian Bible is one of the most fascinating resources to know how Jews lived in the Bayit Sheni period. It describes things Jews are doing that we as Jews don't have sources that are as old as it. So for instance, the Haftarah. Christian Bible describes the Haftarah taking place. We don't have anything comparatively as old. Naming a boy at a Brit Milah, that custom, really, you don't find Jews mentioning it. It was always done. It's mentioned in the Christian Bible, but you don't have Jews kind of codifying that custom, as it were, until the medieval time. Washing Netilat Yadayim is a classic example. If you are unacquainted with the Christian Bible, you might think Chazal just made up Netilat Yadayim, but no, the Christian Bible already describes the fact Jews are doing this. It's a wonderful resource for practices Jews were doing before Chazal truly walked on the scene and started kind of codifying and bringing order to everything. You know, there's so many cool things, and obviously it describes Pesach. There's a lot of wine. So there's actually three things. So I did not put it on the source sheet because even I have lines I'm unwilling to cross. But if you look in, it's in many of the books of the Christian Bible. Obviously, my one is to look in the book of Mark always, you know, because it's my namesake. But I've mentioned this before, but for people who've never heard it, my Hebrew name is Mordechai. This is kind of more Esther relevant than Pesach relevant. As Chazal themselves point out, Mordechai is not a Jewish name. Mordechai is the god Marduka, who was the god of the Persian pantheon, a well-known point Chazal themselves. So it's like, I can either be one of the apostles, or the Persian god, the chief god of the Persian pantheon. Like, either way, my name is heretical. So, you know, sometimes people choose to go by their Hebrew names. There's no point with me. There's no masking it. But there's several, several key points to the Last Supper that you don't need to look in the sources, and you can probably guess what's in them. What's the first thing? Think of the picture of the Last Supper. What's the first thing that comes to the fore? Group setting. It's a group setting. What now? I don't know how many people are familiar with kind of rituals of Catholicism, but what are two things Catholics love doing? One's eating something, one's drinking something, and it's because of what took place at the Last Supper.
The wafer and the wine.
Yeah, the wafer's matzah, and the wine is wine because it's Seder night. They are drinking wine, and they are eating, and they're kind of the...
Many times it's kosher.
Yeah, but much of kind of the debate within the Christian world as to, you know, what was being eaten that night is, well, if it's Seder night, it must have been matzah, which is why it's a wafer and not kind of any, you know, I mean, again, I was only quickly Googling this. Christianity is where kind of my expertise definitely fails. But there's kind of a debate which hinges on this fact of like, well, they were eating matzah, so it has to be more wafery and matzah-like, even though probably matzah in those days was different. But anyway, we have wine and we have matzah. And finally, the Christian Bible also attests to hymns being sung. What are hymns? Hallel. We have multiple references to what we might describe as the Seder now kind of coming together. During the Bayit Sheni period, we now know not only of obviously Pesach, Matzah, and Maror, but also of wine, key element of the Seder, though again, no specified amount of wine, we just know wine was drunk. Hallel, what exactly that means, unclear at this stage, but we know Hallel was done. The group setting, and remember, way back in the Torah, there's some kind of educational aspect to it. There's some responsibility for everyone to know what they are doing. But, again, all of this is within the understanding that it takes place within Yerushalayim. What would people have done who lived outside of Yerushalayim? A Yom Tov meal. They would have had, you know, it would have been Kasher LePesach, because it's still Pesach, but they would not have done the Seder of its time. The Seder of its time was only able to be done in Yerushalayim with the Pesach, with the Maror, with the Hallel, with the wine. They would have just had, you know, just like every other Yom Tov, we have a Yom Tov meal. They would have had a Kasher LePesach Yom Tov meal. And in fact, a lot of these sources come from a book called Haggadah of the Sages, which is a translation of a book by Shmuel and Zev Safrai, who are a family of, there's like a whole family of Safrai in Israel. And they all like do this kind of like reading history out of sources. They actually go through this kind of interesting, kind of not mathematical calculation of how many Jews would actually have been celebrating, you know, Pesach in Yerushalayim in the times of the second Beit HaMikdash, and they work out not a lot. Like in terms of numbers, a lot, but compare that to the population, not a lot. So, you know, that was kind of, you know, what exactly everyone else was doing, probably nothing too spectacular. However, correct. But aren't you supposed to ever stop Jews from just digging, you know, Jews haven't changed that much in 2000 years. Obviously something major happens to change this Yerushalayim centric aspect of Pesach, and that's the destruction of Yerushalayim. When you no longer have a Beit HaMikdash, when you no longer have the central focus of Seder, which is bringing the Korban Pesach, all of a sudden you're in a problem. All of a sudden you have a problem. You don't know what to do. And that's the challenge facing the Tanaim, the rabbis of the Mishnah. So something we've never really discussed, and hopefully at some point, probably in the fall, we'll take a kind of more broader overview of what is the purpose of the Mishnah, what is the purpose of the Gemara, where exactly, you know, how exactly, what's it doing, the history of it. We've never really done that, but we don't need to be too acquainted with it. But nonetheless, the best way to try and understand what the Tanaim are trying to do is recollect what took place during the times of the Beit HaMikdash and translate that into things people can do nowadays. Because you can no longer do many of the things people can do in the Beit HaMikdash, but they're trying to figure it out. Now, the analogy people often, you know, often use, at least if you're familiar with this idea, what I call football, you call soccer, but you have kind of, how did soccer come about? You had this kind of proto game being played, you know, across England, and eventually kind of a group of people got together and they decided these are the rules. And they kind of took various things people were doing and they brought order and they wrote, you know, some things this is what we will do, some things this is what we won't do anymore. And then they have the official rules. It goes through a bit of a, you know, process. And then that then gets exported to the rest of the world as it is. And Chazal kind of do a similar thing. The kind of the whole redaction, editing of the Mishnah is kind of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi is selecting different views of Chazal and deciding which ones stay in, which ones don't make the cut. And in general, though, they're also trying to figure out and bring order to what's exactly going on here. Because something important to realize about all the Mishnayot we're about to slog through is, by and large, the rabbis mentioned live in the era after the Beit HaMikdash was already destroyed. The only two occasions we get rabbis from the Beit HaMikdash era, Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, two schools of thought from the times of the Beit HaMikdash, those are non-kind of Pesach specific. It's a discussion about brachot, about the order of Kiddush, and it's about, you know, halal related stuff, which we already know was taking place in the times of the Beit HaMikdash. Most of the entire discussion in the Mishnah about Seder night is entirely people post Beit HaMikdash who are trying to figure out, Jews have been doing this for hundreds, if not, you know, thousands of years. But what does it actually look like now? Because in the times of the Beit HaMikdash, it can be fluid. People can do whatever they want. Everyone knows what they're doing. But now we're trying to reconstruct what's happening. We're trying to export this idea to Jewry as a whole. We need to try and figure out exactly what we're doing. We need to try and figure out exactly what the Seder should now look like, which is in part based on what it would have looked like, but also through kind of them trying to figure out what it should look like nowadays. You know, the perfect analogy in this building is take the Adam Street Shul. We know a lot about what the members of the Adam Street Shul did back in like 1912. And there's a lot of stuff we don't know, and we kind of just wing it by being like, maybe. And some people who are like the grandchildren of members are like, maybe, you know, once a year, you know, my grandfather would, you know, run through the town wearing an apron, swinging a frying pan. Maybe, no, that was, you know, but like there's certain things where it's like, was this a thing or was this a thing? You know, and it's trying to figure out, and you know, we're kind of a bit hamstrung because we don't have all the data, but we do the best we can do based on what we have. And Chazal are in many ways doing that same thing. The project of Mishnah and even more so the Gemara. And what's going to be really cool, we're going to see next week, is how some of the things referenced in the Mishnah are references that are like, it's blatantly obvious. Everyone knows in the times of the Mishnah what this is. And by the times of Chazal, they're like, in times of the Gemara, they're like, what is this? And everyone's like, maybe it's this, maybe it's that. Maybe, and you know, again, trying to recollect things after something's been destroyed always leads to debates, leads to questions, trying to figure out what it is. So now, as I said at the beginning of this year, now comes the really, really cool part, but also the kind of repetitive part of where we are close reading Mishnayot, to try and tease out what's being contributed, what's new, what's developing in the Haggadah that has never been seen before, or alternatively, has never been so clearly articulated. So let's begin with source number 5, which is the first Mishnah of the 10th Perek, the 10th chapter of Masechet Pesachim. The 10th chapter is when you get to the discussion of actual Seder night. Everything until then is more kind of Beit HaMikdash-centric. Arvei Pesachim samuch lemincha lo yochal adam ad shetach shach. Once it gets to mincha time, you can't eat. The Safrai family have a really fascinating explanation for this. Most people would work right until evening. However, the wealthy members of society could eat earlier because they didn't have to be kind of out in the fields or out in their jobs until late. So they argue this is specifically to kind of make everyone conform to the same thing. So even on Seder night, and again, it goes back to that shared sense of community, even the wealthiest members of society who don't need to wait to eat have to wait to eat on Seder night. And as we see, ve'afilu ani shebi Yisrael lo yochal ad sheyasev, even a poor person has to still act like someone who's free. So again, it's coming at both ends. The wealthy have to eat at the time that the poor and the regular people eat. And at the same time, the regular people, the poor people, have to act as though they're wealthy. They have to recline, as any, you know, wealthy person would do back in the day. V'lo yiftechu lo me'arba kosot shel yayin v'afilu min hatamchoy. And the community has to make sure everyone has enough of 4 cups of wine, even if that's basically going from kind of the communal coffers for charity. First major thing here is suddenly wine has gone from they drank wine to 4 cups. What's really interesting is that these 4 cups, as we're going to see, become the pace setters of the Seder. The Seder actually revolves around these 4 cups. There are a lot of explanations given as to why exactly 4. It should be noted that all of those explanations come after the practice. Michael, you'd asked me this question like a couple of weeks ago. There are some things where we have a reason, and because of the reason, we do the practice. And there are other things where we have the practice, and the practice has been done, and we're like, we need a good reason for it. This sounds like a good reason. For whatever reason, Chazal wanted 4 cups of wine. 4 cups of wine. Why? Everyone tries to think of a compelling, and some of the answers are beautiful, some of the answers are lovely, and everyone shares them at their Seder table, but fundamentally, the explanation comes after the practice. Unlike, you know, here, you know, unlike in other situations where the explanation drives the practice.
It could have easily been that in the time of the second Beit HaMikdash, it was a custom amongst whoever lived in the land that you drank 4 cups at a big meal.
Exactly.
And that's why they came up with 4.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So what's really interesting in the Safari, one of the big things about Haggadah research, and I'll say at this point, I love the Safrai Haggadah of the Sages. I don't buy everything. There has been a lot of scholarship done on the history of the Seder and its reasons. And as much as a lot of it is compelling, a lot of it is not compelling. So one of the most popular explanations for the Seder is that the entire thing is kind of an anti-Christian polemical ritual, is generally not accepted by scholars because the Seder happens a lot earlier than Christianity started to bother Jews, kind of thing. You know, Christianity at first wasn't frustrating enough to the Jewish community to be a problem. Polemics emerge kind of later on in time, and the Seder is already happening for a long time before that, as we are kind of seeing. There's the question of how much does it compare to kind of the Greco-Roman, you know, meal of the time. So the Safrais point out that wine, the idea of kind of four specific, you know, cups of wine is not necessarily something that there's any corroborating evidence for being a thing. It seems to be this unique idea to the Seder. What they do suggest, and I actually do think this is kind of, this is compelling, is they suggest a very technical reason for the wine drinking, and that is wine drinking in general is paired with significant mitzvot to emphasize their significance. The example is Kiddush. Kiddush on Friday nights, we pair it with wine to kind of emphasize and underscore just how focal it is. We drink one cup of wine at Kiddush. The second cup of wine we drink after rounding out the completion of Magid, the kind of one of the focal aspects of the Seder. So obviously we want to lend that bracha at the end more importance. We pair it with wine. The third wine comes after Birkat HaMazon, after benching, which is kind of a standard thing. That's not unusual. So again, there goes our third cup. And the fourth one comes at the end of Halal, which again is one of the major aspects of the Seder throughout history. So the wine pairs with that to again lend its significance. If you look at kind of, you know, the example of kind of the least significant part of the Seder, the songs at the end, we don't do wine at that point because like, eh. But like the important stuff at the Seder, the really crucial stuff, we drink wine and we make a borei pirat gafen. So I think that's a, you know, that's a nice, you know, technical reason to explain why. Source number six. We're not actually going to look at it in any detail for the sake of time, but it's a debate between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. So this is fine. This is Second Temple, but it is debating, you know, which order do we go when making Kiddush? Because, you know, this is kind of part of a broader discussion we're not going to get into, but it's a technical question over what's the order of Kiddush. The really interesting things start to happen with Mishnah 3. Heviu lefanav. They bring it before him. Metabel b'chazeret. They dip the lettuce. Ad shemagia lefarperet hapat. Until he reaches, this is the person who's running the Seder, until he reaches that which are coming as the matzah. Heviu lefanav matzah v'chazeret v'charoset u'shnei tavshilin. Matzah, chazeret, charoset, two cooked foods. Af al pisha ein charoset mitzvah. Even though charoset is not a mitzvah, it comes with all of these other things. Rebbe Eliezer b'Rebbe Tzadok omer mitzvah. He disagreed. No, it is a mitzvah. Uva mikdash hayu mevi'im lefanav gufo shel Pesach. And at the in the time of the temple, this is when they would also do the Pesach. So again, we are kind of talking about the past when we talk to the Beit HaMikdash. This Mishnah introduces a lot of things. Something is brought before him. So if you look in the English, there's a little editorial square bracket, the vegetables, which is a reference to carapace. This is how a lot of people understand the Mishnah. It's describing a prior kind of thing being brought. This is the carapace. And we also get other key aspects of the Seder. Charoset. This is the first time we are introduced to the fact that we have another aspect to Seder night. The Seder plate at this point in this Mishnah is basically four because we have charoset. And charoset's not a mitzvah. That's what the Mishnah wants us to know. But still, it's included within all these other important, it's in all these other important, you know, mitzvah objects. Really interestingly is the fact that some Rishonim read this Mishnah as implying back in the day they did the meal before anything else. Because basically this is describing the meal of the Seder, and next we're gonna get into, you know, the rest of the Seder, the Maggid thing. But the counter argument to that is like, once it starts describing food, it just, you know, it's a thematic kind of thing. The Mishnah kind of does this because the Mishnah is supposed to be, you know, you're supposed to be able to recall it from memory. So once it picks up one theme, it just continues that theme until it's done. So it's not necessarily describing the fact that the meal took place right at the beginning. They started with the meal. But what's really interesting here is, again, that crucial aspect of, for some people, it makes Pesach. It makes the same night charoset. So it's not a mitzvah according to everyone except Rabbi Eliezer ben Tzadok. But nonetheless, it's introduced already here in the Mishnah, which again is cool. A focal part of the Seder is already introduced. Things are interesting though if you turn to source number 8. Source number 8 is not a Mishnah, it's a Tosefta. So the Tosefta is a parallel work by the Tanaim, and it is about three times as large as the Mishnah. And it includes the views of Rabbanim a generation later. It is both alternative to Mishnah and commentary on the Mishnah. It's really cool. And it includes a lot of things that Chazal themselves in the Gemara will later incorporate into their own kind of decision making. But fundamentally, the Tosefta presents what are very often alternative views that Rebbe, it's like the B-side of the Tanaitic literature. It didn't make the cut. Rebbe Yehuda Nasi didn't think it was worth keeping, but nonetheless, the editors of the Tosefta thought, no, let's stick this in there anyway. And the Tosefta is a fascinating source of so many things. We saw in the Purim series how it preserves the fact that the Megillah was not originally read at night. Tosefta is really, really cool. Felice, you have a question?
What are the dates for when these were written down?
200 CE is the end of the Mishnah. Rough ballpark date. So again, the Tosefta includes the students of Rebbe Yehuda Hanasi, but it also goes back. The Mishnah only incorporates four generations. Four generations, the Tosefta has a fifth generation. The first generation of the Mishnah live in the times of the Beit HaMikdash. Already after that, you start to get generations post. Something that we don't often notice, because you have to have it pointed out to you, but the Mishnah is basically follows Rebbe Akiva for basic, because Rebbe Yehuda HaNasi was like a grand Talmud of Rebbe Akiva. So even though Rebbe Akiva has debates with other of his contemporaries, they never win. And the people who follow that generation are basically all the students, painting with a broad brush here, but are basically all the students of Rebbe Akiva. And they're the only people who get kind of voice in the Mishnah after that point. But yeah, so 200 CE, the period of Chazal are 200 to 600 CE. And obviously the last Tana is the first Amora. The last rabbi of the Mishnah is the first rabbi of the Gemara. That's kind of how it works. And Chazal kind of, again, there'll be another time when we'll talk about this kind of in detail because it's really, really cool and fascinating. But yeah. But the Tosefta is parallel to the Mishnah. And it describes something very different. Hashamash machvish bivnei ma'im v'noten lifnei ha'orchim af al pisha in raya ladava af al pisha in raya ladava zecha ladava, and then I cut off the rest of it. The dipping here is not the dipping of karpas like we do. It's the innards of the Pesach, and he places it before people, and then the Tosefta is like, that this is, does not come from anywhere, but here's our proof. So it's something that's already being done. So it's basically to whet people's appetite. These are the hors d'oeuvres. So whereas, you know, so it depends kind of on your, again, on your philosophy of delicious foods. Some people are like, I take the celery any day of the week, and other people are like, the idea of like the insides of roasted lamb kind of sound delicious. But either way, so already what we do see here, and again, the Tosefta is really cool to look at and compare and contrast. We see a major debate of something, what we take as a given, and we all read that Mishnah as saying, ah, it's karpas. But not necessarily, because the Tosefta corroborates a lot of this stuff, and that's why we're not really looking at it that much. Subtle differences here and there, which are interesting, but then we'd be here for 3 hours. But, you know, here we have a complete and utter departure.
So this is dipping, it's just a different kind.
Correct. We assume the dipping is karpas, but there's no reason to indicate this. Pay close attention to source number 9. The next 3 Mishnayot are the Mishnayot that basically take us from until now, where we like have this wishy-washy kind of Pesach night ritual. After Mishnayot 4, 5, and 6, sources 9, 10, and 11, we are going to be left with basically the Seder in its, you know, we are going to have the outline of basically the entire Seder. But there are going to be some really, really key differences. So listen closely to source number 9. And tell me what's really striking about it. The thing that's not striking about it, spoiler, it's Manish Tana. The thing that's not striking about it is the fact that Manish Tana is different. We'll talk about that in a second. There's something else about Manish Tana which is striking that this Mishnah portrays, which is completely different to what everyone does. Okay, Mazgulo Kosheni. They bring the second cup of wine. Vekan Haben Shoel Aviv. This is where the son asks questions to the father. Ve'im ein da'at ba'ben. If the son doesn't have enough to really know what's going on, aviv melamdo, the father should teach him. Manish tana halayla hazeh mikol halilot. Why is this night different from all of the nights? Shebechol halilot anu achlin chametz u matzah. Halayla hazeh kulo matzah. We otherwise always eat, you know, we can eat either, and now we have to eat matzah. Shebechol halilot anu achlin sha'ar yirako. We can eat any vegetable. Halayla hazeh maro. We have to eat maro. Shebechol halilot anu achlin basar tzli shaluk umavushal. On any other night, we can eat meat, whether it's roasted, stewed, or boiled. Halayla hazeh kulo tzali. It can only be roasted. Shebechol halilot anu matpilin pa'am achat. All other nights, we dip only once. Halayla hazeh shtei fa'amim. Tonight, two. Ulefi dato shel ben aviv melamdo. And given the intellectual understanding of the child, the father should teach him. Matchil bignut umisayim b'shevach. How do you do so? You start with the disgrace of the Jewish people and end with their glory. V'doresh me arami oved avi. And expound the passage of arami oved avi. Ad shigmor kol ha'parashah, until you finish that section of the Torah. So there's a lot to unpack, because this is basically like 40% of Maggid just in this one Mishnah. So look, yeah, Manish Tana, you know, there's a lot of differences. What's actually kind of cool about a lot of these next few Mishnayot is if you look at manuscripts of Mishnayot, there's a lot of discrepancies between them. No version of Manish Tana is the same as one another in a given manuscript. The Haggadah runs with its own version. The Tosefta does not have Manish Tana, but obviously Manish Tana has in here the idea of eating the Pesach, or in some sense eating the Pesach, which is not something that is being done nowadays. And it references dipping, which is not, whereas we are kind of like, we never dip, because we never dip. Back in those days, they dipped. It doesn't mention reclining, because that wouldn't have been unusual in the times of, you know, in the Greco-Roman world, reclining was normal. So we have those, but there's something really, really major and fundamental about how Manish Tana is introduced. And I read it kind of intentionally to highlight this. Completely different. Who says Manish Tana? Say it louder. The father says Manish Tana. We know Manish Tana to be the formulaic questions every child asks at the Seder, or the youngest person at the Seder asks. That was not its original intention. The original intention of this kind of makes sense. If the point is to educate, you never spoon feed children to ask. You ask them the most basic, obvious questions possible. Again, Yair, he's 3.5 years old. You know, every Friday night, it's, you know, we try, you know, Maimo often gives like questions for the parasha. So, you know, we ask him those questions. We're not like, tell us about the parish. It's, well, it begins, you know, with 3.5. He can't tell us anything. But maybe if we ask him a question like, who's the king in the Purim story? After 3 tries, it's not Para. It's not, you know, him. It's Achashver. He'll get it, you know? What the father's doing here is, you know, turning round to a child and being like, and again, the point is, Manish Tana is only for the children who can't ask questions themselves. So they've already had... Children past a certain intellectual level should be able to talk about Pesach. You should be able to have a conversation. But what is different tonight than all other nights? Have you, and I'm using my patronizing voice because, you know, but like, what's different? Have you noticed the difference? All the other nights we can have matzah and chametz. But have you noticed tonight we're only having matzah? Oh, yeah. Like, again, it's not kids aren't asking these questions. It's the father asks the child the most basic observations possible in order to get him to notice. So that is something that I think is really, really cool, that we do the complete opposite. If I had to delete, I pulled the translation from Safaria, which is a great website. They translate this. I had to delete it. They translated implying, they like put in square brackets like the son asks the father. And it's like, no, those square brackets change the translation. We don't need them. We don't need the Mishnah to conform to our practice, which is a big problem with some of these Mishnayot, in that they are edited to make them fit with what we do. But fundamentally, really, really cool, Manish Tana was supposed to be asked by the father to his child.
What about the
Yeah, if he doesn't know what he's doing. So again, it should...
Does it mean at a certain age the child
would be... It's not even an intellectual maturity age. There's a certain age at which kids know what's going on. They can tell you about Pesach. It may be, you know, childlike, but fundamentally kids at a certain age are intellectually mature enough to talk about Pesach. Manishnar is for those kids who can't even, it's for Yair, who cannot process such things because he's 3.5, but if we point out the blatantly obvious, maybe he'll like wonder why. So this, what's really cool about this, is we mentioned right at the beginning the educational component to Seder. This is the first actual, you know, practical, all the other evidence we've seen until now, we've had the group setting a ton of times, we've been introduced to wine and to halal, but this is the first time we really get this idea of education being a key value and being kind of codified into the law, into the idea of what Seder is. But we also get the outline of Maggid. And this is something we'll see next week, as the Mishnah knows exactly what it means by Matchil Bignut Umesayim Leshevach, begin with the disgrace of the Jewish people and end with their praise. But in the Haggadah itself, as we'll see next week, we run that twice with two different competing opinions on what that means, because by the time it gets to the Gemara, it's like, what does that mean? Maybe it means this, maybe it means this, and we do both in the Haggadah, you know, because that's what we do in some situations, to make sure we're doing it, and then we get the major thing of being Doresh Me Arami Oved Avi. The passage of Arami Oved Avi, my father was a wandering Aramean, though the Haggadah, and we'll talk about this in the third week, the Haggadah translates it very differently and incorrectly to Lavan tried to Arami Oved Avi, and Aramean tried to destroy my father, and we'll talk about it in the third week, but that paragraph in Sefer Devarim was what one recited as they brought their Bikurim, their first fruits of the Beit HaMikdash, and it summarizes the story of Yitziat Mitzrayim. That's what we are supposed to Doresh. Doresh is important because it means expound. Learn from it. You're not just reading it. So the educational aspect again. And you'll see in the Haggadah, we do this kind of really, you know, exhaustively, where we learn from each and every verse 15 different principles. But the point is, discuss it. Learn it. Understand it. It's not just the perfunctory recitation of verses. You have to actually understand it, follow it, you know, understand it and process it. I'm going to read very quickly source number 10. Rabban Gamliel Haya Omer. Rabban Gamliel used to say, not every manuscript of the Mishnah has the word Haya here. I'm not really going to get into this because I was reading up on it and it's kind of cool, but it's kind of detailed. There are multiple people who might be Rabban Gamliel. There was Rabban Gamliel who lived in the times of the Beit HaMikdash. If we read it, Rabban Gamliel Haya Omer, we're talking about the guy in the Beit HaMikdash. This is what he would say. Kol shalom ha-shalosh ha-dvarim elu ba-pesach lo yatza yidei chovato ve-elu hein. Pesach, matzah, umaro. You've got to reference all three things, the Pesach, the matzah, and the maro. Why do we want it to be Rabban Gamliel from the times of the Beit HaMikdash? What do we not do, never, ever, ever in our seders in a post-Beit HaMikdash world? Yeah, we do not eat roasted lamb on Pesach. We don't eat lamb on Pesach. We don't look at lamb on Pesach. We do not do so. However, the Safarais argue, and they have very compelling sources to marshal here, there were many Jews who, after the Beit HaMikdash, were eating grilled lamb. And there is another Rabban Gamliel this could be, Rabban Gamliel Omer, Rabban Gamliel of Yavna, who's living in the post-Beit HaMikdash times, who they argue was one of the people who kind of kept this practice. It was a normal practice in the times post-Beit HaMikdash that has since fallen out of favor, that was written out of a practice we do. But they would call this the Pesach in memory of the Pesach. They would eat something reminiscent of the Pesach offering in order to recall it. We then get very quickly Pesach al Shema. Why Pesach? Pesach al Shem She Pesach Hamakom al Batei Avotinu Mitzrayim. God skipped over our homes. Matzah al Shem She Nigalnu Avotinu Mitzrayim. God revealed Himself in Mitzrayim. Maro al Shem She Maro Amitzrayim Etchayi Avotinu Mitzrayim. Maro because they made our ancestors' lives difficult. In the Haggadah goes crazy with this. We don't get one-liners, we get paragraphs explaining the Pesach, the Matzah, and Maror. Again, something not to discuss right now. And then we get B'chol Dor V'Dor, which is the title of the series. B'chol Dor V'Dor Chayav Adam Lirot Et Atzmo Ki'ilu Hu Yatza Mimitzrayim. You have to see yourself as though you left Egypt. We say this is literally, just as with Manish Tana, this is what's so cool. Text verbatim in our Haggadah, more or less. שנאמר, והגנת לבנך ביום ההוא לאמור, בעבור זה עשה אדוני לי בצאתי ממצרים, לפיכך. Again, if you had a Haggadah in front of you, you could read these words off the Haggadah itself. Again, we don't have this with the Siddur. This is what makes the Haggadah so cool. The text is already being found in the Mishnah. לפיכך, אנחנו חייבים להודות להלל, לשבח, לפועל, לרומם, להדל, לברך, להלל, לקלס, למי שעשה לאבותינו ולנו את כל הניסים או אלו, הוציאנו מעבדת לחירות, מיאגו לשמחו, מעבר ליום טוב, מאפילה לאור גדול, ומשיבוד לגולה, ונאמר לפניו, הללויה. Text literally from the Haggadah is already found in the Mishnah. And this is kind of the introduction to the rest of Maggid. Finally, take a look at source number 11. We have a little bit of a question. Ad Heichan hu Omer. Wait, we start Halal at this point, as is well known. We start Halal already before we start the meal. Even though Halal in the Seder comes later, we pick up Halal a couple of paragraphs in, and we start Halal after Maggid, because we literally read the Mishnah, and that gets us going with Halal. Ad Heichan hu Omer. But until when should we do it? Beit Shammai. So again, we get our Beit Sheni rabbis here. Beit Shammai Omrim ad Em Habanim Smecha, the first paragraph of Halal. Uveit Hillel Omrim ad Chalamish Lamayin Omayim, the second paragraph of Halal. V'chotem B'Geula, and we end with the Bracha of Geula. What's interesting here is the Haggadah does not even... The Haggadah, I mean, this is kind of a binary choice, unlike what we'll see next week with non-binary choices. We follow Hillel here. Like, there's no even, the Haggadah does not reference this as a debate at any point. Of course, we follow Hillel. Rabbi Tarfon Omer, Asher Ga'alnu V'Ga'alet Avotenu Mimitzrayim. Rabbi Tarfon suggests the bracha. V'lo Haya Choten, but he wouldn't add anything else at that point. Rabbi Akiva Omer. Rabbi Tarfon and Rabbi Akiva are the two big debaters. By the way, guess who we're gonna follow? Is it Rabbi Akiva or Rabbi Tarfon? Exactly. Rabbi Tarfon like literally only occurs on the Haggadah as the foil to Rabbi Akiva. But anyway, Rabbi Akiva Omer, Kein Hashem Elokeinu v'Elokei Avotenu Yigienu l'Moadim v'L'Ragalim Acharim Haboim L'Kratenu L'Shalom Tzumeichim B'Vinyan Yirecha V'Sasim B'Avodatecha V'Nochal Sham Min Hazvachim Min Hapsachim Ad Baruch Ata Hashem Ga'al Yisrael. That's how Maggid ends, with the Bracha of Ga'al Yisrael. Then we just get very quickly, Mazgu Lo Kos Shlishi Mevarech al Mizono. We have the third cup, which is the brach, which is for benching. Revi gomer alav et halal. With the fourth, you finish up halal. Va'omer alav birkat hashir. Then you finish up halal. Bein kosot halalu im rotzel ishtot yishter, bein shlish revi lo yishter. You can't drink after that point. Fine. Source 13, v'ein maftirin achar ha-pesach afikoman. We cannot do anything after the Afikoman. This is the best example we'll talk about next week, where Chazal are like, what is this? Because it's not a Jewish word, it's a Greek word. It's a Greek word. The explanation is well known, and I'm not sure if I even spoke about it last year, but anyway. Yashnu mix, and then it just talks about, fine. The rest of the Mishnayot don't describe anything relevant to the Seder, but at this point, after these Mishnayot, we already have most of the Haggadah filled in. We have the wine. We have dipping. We have the broad overview of Maggid, including explicit things like Manish Tana, the Lefichach passage. We include Rabban Gamliel Haya Omer. We have the instruction to teach children. We have, obviously, the meal. We have a reference to an Afikoman, whatever that is. At this stage, we don't know. We have a lot of things. And this is what's so cool, is on Seder night, in a few weeks from now, this is all already in here. This is about as ancient as it comes. Some of those things were protoform, you know, Pesach Matzah Maror, group setting education, already found in the Torah and Tanakh. Wine and Halal were already evident in Beit Sheni, but now Chazal really bring forth in the Mishnah the text of the Haggadah in its purest form we have. There are two other cool things that I didn't, one of them is on the source sheet, one of them didn't, but there's a limit to how many sheets this could be before everyone, you know, before we destroy too many trees. So the first is there is a famous story in the Haggadah of the sages in Bnei Barak. The Tosefta preserves a story which is completely different, but kind of the same. They're in Lod, and very different in every way, but it's like a parallel story. But the other thing which is cool is take a look at source number 14, which is again from the Tosefta. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Chotvin Matzah Letinokot, Bishvil Shelo Yeshnu. We steal the matzah from the kids so that they don't fall asleep. Now, different families have different customs. In Ruth's family, the kids steal the matzah. In my family, it was always the, you know, my father hid the matzah from us. It's always nice to know when Ruth's family are wrong. But we see in the, you know, different people do different things, but we see already in the stuff that this was being done. So again, this is a custom, a cute little custom. We do it, Sadie and I. Oh, it's always so fun. It's always so nice. In the times of the Mishnah, they're already doing it. That is cool. We don't get that with most other things where we can trace the origin of a custom so far back to at least the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash era. Like we don't, most of the things we do are so far removed from that world. And yet so much of the Seder night is just a pure recreation of what was done during the times of the Mishnah, post Bayit Sheni, as the Tanaim sought to bring, the pun I titled this little subsection, Bring Order to the Seder, which I laughed at for a few minutes as I wrote it and sent it to a couple of other people. But they bring order. They codify the Seder, and we still do the same things to this day. But what we'll start to see next week, some of the other things emerge in the Haggadah. The Haggadah will start to fill out more as it moves through the times of the Amoraim, the rabbis of the Gemara, and the Gaonim, the rabbis who came afterwards. They do two things. They're going to throw in a few extra, you know, aspects of the Haggadah, and they're also going to ask on some of these things, what does that mean? What does it mean? Begin with the disgrace and end with the praise of the Jewish people. What be this mysterious Afikomen? And in trying to understand and explain what these things are, they will also continue to give us the Seder as we have it to this day. And we'll hopefully by the end of next week, basically see that the Haggadah as we have it is basically already done at that point in history. And yet in the final week, as I mentioned, we'll look at least two examples. One example will show how the Haggadah ended up dictating a major aspect of Jewish philosophy. And at the same time, how we as 20th century, 21st century, but it was in the 20th century, how we as 20th century Jews completely subverted the meaning of one of the Haggadah's most famous rituals to our own ends, and thus changed the complete understanding so much so that no one knows the original reason behind the ritual anymore. We will investigate it in the third week, but hopefully everyone has been able to appreciate already just how cool the Haggadah is and Seder night is, and how early and ancient it is, and how quickly it begins to be formed, and as we continue to see it crystallized over the generations of Jewish history.